For the week of June 8th, 2014, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 239, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And at the Anderson Compound in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz.
The Anderson Compound. What is the Anderson Compound? I don't think I'm familiar.
It's my sister's home.
Ah, okay. And I guess her last name is Anderson.
It is now.
It is now. Okay. It wasn't always.
It was Leeds. And before that, it was Giltz. I always find it weird that women change their names. I know less nowadays. Sometimes they you know, hyphenate or this. I'm just like, that just seems odd that like you were that, now you're this, and then you get a divorce, and so now you're something. I just find it strange. When I marry a woman, I'll be like, keep your own identity, stay strong, or we'll take some new name together.
Okay.
That's what I say. And Tracy Morgan is not dead, though he was in a serious car accident, so he's in a hospital. That made big news, of course, Tracy Morgan from 30 Rock and Saturday Night Live, so hopefully he'll get better and recover fully. But it's nice that nobody has died this week. I'm sure plenty of people have. We don't mean to imply, but it's nice to know we're not going to do an obit this week, but we are going to talk about entertainment news, aren't we?
Yes, and again, for those of our listeners who are just joining us for the first time, for some reason we have begun to do obituaries at the opening of every show. Not sure why, but as you say, Michael, there are no obituaries to speak of this week, at least not in the entertainment world. However, the Tony Awards were announced, so we'll see which shows might get a big bounce from their Tony Award wins, and more importantly, from their performances, which performances really shined through on last night's telecast. We'll also tell you how releasing films on VOD, video on demand, at the same time as they appear in theaters, it's kind of becoming the new normal. During Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're talking about the box office around the world, not just your city or your state or your country, but the box office around the world. We get our information from RentTrack. We have a link in our show notes. We also piece together info from Variety and Hollywood Reporter and other sources. And the number one movie around the world, no, it is not some weepy with teenage children with cancer. It is Tom Cruise in Edge of Tomorrow. It grossed $111 million worldwide. It opened last week in some territories, so its total is now $140 million, a decent start for a movie that needs to gross $500 million just to break even.
And this is a movie that critics generally seem to like.
Oh, it got excellent. Seemed to get excellent reviews. So it's a shame because, like, as I think Box Office Profits said, that's one of those box office prognosticators websites. I like them, and they said, you know, hey, it's kind of funny. Last year, he made a terrible sci-fi movie called Oblivion, and that got poor reviews and did poorly, relatively speaking. And now he's got a really good movie. People like it a lot, frankly, especially for the genre. And it hasn't really caught on fire. It did not do great in North America, but that's because some people see the box office as a Manichean competition, but it's not. Yes, another movie won the box office in North America. Yes, The Fault in Our Stars beat Edge of Tomorrow in every territory it opened up in overseas, but that doesn't mean they both can't be winners. But we'll get to The Fault in Our Stars in just another moment. Because
Wait a second. I'd like to go back to this word that you just used.
Uh-huh.
Manichean.
Well, sure. Why not?
Okay, so...
Would you prefer Darwinian?
Okay.
Because Darwin did not come up with the phrase survival of the fittest. That wasn't Darwin. It was another scientist.
Okay, well, I think you should spell Manichean. For our listeners who might want to go look that up in a dictionary, and by for our listeners, I mean myself.
Manichean, I believe it's M-A-N-I-C-H-E-A-N.
Okay, meaning?
Well, look it up.
Okay, fine.
Anyway, I think the context was clear.
I know. These are all jokes, people. Feel free to laugh at any time.
Okay. And number two around the world is Maleficent. Maleficent. See, you've made me screw up now. Manichean. No, that's not the number two movie. It's Maleficent, the retelling of Sleeping Beauty starring Angelina Jolie. $93 million it made. It's at $335 million worldwide. It looks set to become the biggest film in Angelina Jolie's career. Couldn't have come at a better time when she's got really a big directorial film for her coming out at the end of the year called Unbroken. So it's a good year for the Pitt Jolly family.
You know, actually, Unbroken for years, I can't tell you how many years, I mean, 20, 30 years, was called the Lou Zamperini story. It was always
Well, wasn't around for 20, 30 years because the book hasn't been around that long.
Well, when the book was written by
Laura Hillenbrand, the author of Seabiscuit. I've interviewed her. She's a terrific author.
Yes. She titled it Unbroken, and thus it became the title of the film.
Well, it came out like 8 years ago, the book, 6 years ago, something like that.
Right. However, the idea of doing a movie on Lou Zamperini has been around for, it seems like...
He's a prisoner of war from World War II. If you're from Japan, you probably don't want to read the book. It's not a pleasant tale for your country.
Correct.
And I don't know how you're going to make a happy, uplifting film out of this thing, because it's a brutal book. And that makes it sound like it's hard to endure, but it is a terrific work of nonfiction. At number three around the world is The Fault in Our Stars. That is the John Green novel about two dying teenagers. They seem to be dying. One's got cancer, the other one's got something else, I forget what, and they meet, they fall in love. It's romantic, it's sad, you're going to cry, you're going to laugh. It grossed $65 million. It did open up overseas a little bit, but most of that is in North America. It was the number one movie at the box office. It beat out Tom Cruise. In fact, so did Maleficent in North America, but that's okay. This movie has to have one of the biggest gender gaps I have seen in a long time. Like 80% of the people who went were women.
Actually, I would believe 80% of the people who went were teenage girls.
Yeah, exactly. Magic Mike, I think, was the last movie we saw where, like, the only men in the theater were gay men and very unhappy husbands.
You know, I loved all of the stories online that came out this week. How not to cry, 17 ways on how not to cry during Fault in Our Stars.
Well, don't get me about lists, because that has really gone over the top. There isn't a website without 47 lists every day. It's exhausting and tiresome. But I don't get this. I don't understand teenage boys. Why would you not want to go see The Fault in Our Stars? I was at my friend's house talking to his teenage son. Ah, stupid book. Stupid bunch of mawkish sentimentality. Blah. I'm like, what are you, an idiot? Tell the girls, hey, who wants to go see Fault in Our Stars? You're going to end up at a theater with four girls. They're all going to be crying, leaning on your shoulder. You provide a little sympathy. It's teenage dating 101.
This is like teenage dating catnip.
That's right. Come on. You're like, you're going to make fun of the book? You should say, oh, I had to read it for a class. It's great. Oh, let's go see the movie. Then you get to hang out with all the girls. It's another good, you want to do that? Join the theater department. Because it's all girls, and the only other guys there are gay men. So, again, high school boys, this is your chance to shine. Show your sympathy, hang out with the girls, have a good time. And by the way, if you're taking dating advice from me, you're really in trouble. At number four around the world is X-Men, Days of Future Past. We'll get back to Fault in Our Stars in a minute. X-Men made $56 million. It's at $611 million worldwide. And number five, not doing so great, but it's probably going to make money, is A Million Ways to Die in the West. $13 million. It's now at $50 million worldwide. In fact, I cost it some money because I was talking to another teenager, a girl and a boy. They were deciding what movie to see at the drive-in. They were going to go see A Million Ways to Die in the West, but Neighbors was also playing. And I said, well, if you're choosing between those two, I think I'd go see Neighbors.
Well, first of all, what were you, in the 1950s? You were at the drive-in?
Well, in Atlanta, they got a drive-in, the Twilight drive-in cinemas, and I love the drive-in. It's fun. If you're a teenager, who wouldn't like the drive-in?
That's true.
But anyway, yeah. And I didn't say that in front of the parents. They said they might go see A Million Ways to Die in the West, and I almost said, well, you know, if you don't care about paying attention to the movie, that's probably a good choice. But then I realized that probably wouldn't be an appropriate joke to make. All right, at number six around the world is Godzilla. That's just about to hit $400 million. It had a good launch. Not doing so great anymore. It's slowing down quite a bit. No one's going to lose any money over it, but I don't know if they're going to rush to make a sequel. At number seven is Neighbors, the film I talked about. $8,800,000, $930. And that extra $30, probably about $15 or $18 of that is because of me.
Okay, that's the two teenagers you sent.
That's right. They went to see it. $223 million worldwide. It only costs $18 million to make. That's Hollywood's idea of a really good idea. At number eight is 22 Jump Street. Jonah Hill made some unfortunate news, but a lovable guy, tearful apology for being goaded into making a slur out of paparazzi. He made a gay slur. Man, this guy is a very pro-gay friendly person, and he felt terrible, and he went on Jimmy Fallon, and he gave a really heartfelt, sweet apology. And nobody was jumping all over him because they knew where his heart was, and they knew, you know, of course, you shouldn't make a slur like that ever, but... You know, this slur has been around, and everybody said it when they were kids. And, you know, so it's not like the N-word or some other thing. And everybody knew he was a very active person supporting the gay community. So he was not in any hot water, but he really was upset that he had done it and made a really sweet, lovely. I mean, he did more helping gay rights, by the way, by saying the slur and apologizing in the way he did than almost anything else.
Well, I don't necessarily. I do know that he got into some hot water. I never even.
Well, you know, I think it was a TMZ guy. I don't know. I mean, I think these people are scum. I'm sorry. You know, you spend your day harassing people to try and get them to react so they will say something and do something on camera that makes them look stupid. Well, I don't know how you sleep at night doing that. You're harassing people that go to the grocery store. They're with their kids. You make fun of their appearance. You call them nasty names. And every once in a while, you get lucky and they say something. And then you get to sell that photo or that video for a lot of money, assuming you're a freelancer or, you know, your boss is happy.
Well, not to get off topic here, but there was
I think we're on topic.
Well, there was a tragedy in Santa Barbara a while back. You know, a week or so ago, where a unfortunately mentally ill 22-year-old went around shooting up the place.
And
not to talk about that particular incident, that particular person lived in my neighborhood, and the parents lived in my neighborhood, and they have a young son.
Oh, they must be surrounded by cameras.
The school at which the son goes to actually had to say, please stay home. We have the cameras from Entertainment Tonight. We have the cameras from TM. Like, your son is being followed around the campus by all these cameras. Oh. Can you please keep him home? And I felt so bad, not only for the parents and this kid who, you know, really didn't have anything to do with this crime necessarily, but also I just felt, you know, how is it that Entertainment Tonight and TMZ, how can they sleep at night?
Yeah. And the Entertainment Tonight probably didn't send someone. It was probably a freelancer doing it for them because they're supposed to be the good ones.
Right.
They're
exactly.
The ones who've always said, no. And yeah, I think Clooney got down on them and said, well, you should never use this footage from these people, you know? And I think they were making a push towards that. So I don't know if they were there, but it's probably national media too. I mean, it probably wasn't just the paparazzi for something like that because that's a hard news story. But again, how is that news following the little brother going back to school? You know, it's just, it's vile. Oh, anyway, that's happy.
Yes.
22 Jump Street, the sequel, opened up in two territories overseas, made $8.8 million. I'm not sure how that compares to how the movie did for the first film, but it looks like a decent start. And number nine is Overheard 3, that Hong Kong film that I love, the one with two sequels, all with the same cast, playing different characters, so you never know who's going to die. And number 10 is Frozen. And Overheard 3 is at about $50 million. Frozen is still chugging along. The South Korean film we also talked about, A Hard Day, is chugging along. Amazing Spider-Man 2 is about to hit $700 million. And then towards the bottom, there's a new film. It's called The Crying Man. Again, South Korea, because boy, they are on fire. It made $2.5 million. It's at $4 million and counting. Its title is literally translated into The Crying Man, but a better title would probably be No Tears for the Dead. And it's about a hitman who accidentally kills a little girl when he's on a job, and he's distraught and he decides he's going to stop. But of course, his boss pulls him in for one last job, the famous one last job. He has to kill one more person. And who does it turn out to be but the grieving mother of the little girl he killed? Oh, my God, what an emotional trauma.
Wow, that is a great. If I were, you know, a studio head, I'd be trying to remake that movie.
Yeah, I don't know about that. That strikes me as a, you know, he's going to run off with, you know, it sounds a little tacky. I like the other one, though. But yeah, those are the box office. So let's go back to The Fault in Our Stars. Now, this novel by John Green, he's a very well-known novelist in the young adult genre, very popular for a number of books over the years. But he's almost as well-known for being a vlogger, a video blogger. He and his brother do these series of videos together, extremely popular on YouTube. They're very positive, very good guys. He was almost to join as a minister or a pastor of some sort. But he's done these books, and his books are not religiously oriented as such, but he has a very positive outlook on life and pushes a really positive thing. He has fans are like nerds. They embrace being nerds. That's the joke. And he has a very big online following. That's why the trailer was such a huge success. It was the most liked trailer in YouTube history. That's why people were screaming to go see this movie. And now this film did a little trick, didn't they, to boost the box office even further.
Well, what, they opened up on Thursday night?
No, that's not a trick, but they had a special event screening where you could watch the movie and pay a premium price, like $25, to get a ticket to be like the first ones to see the film in a particular theater around the country. And then log in video wise, they live stream John Green and some of the cast in one location, and people all over the country could look at them and see them reacting to how fans like the movie on opening night. So they're sort of like attending a premiere in a way, but they also get a back and forth with John Green and the stars. So it's just an extra way to say, hey, let's raise the price from $10 to $25. And the other studios are like, that's a really good idea.
Right.
You watch the movie and then you get to see a peek at the stars. You're the first to see it. You're really excited. And there's Tom Cruise.
Right. So, well, think about it this way. It used to be that a hardcover book was more money than a paperback, because if you went out and bought a hardcover book of Stephen King's work, I mean, you were a real fan. So they versioned something. They windowed something. The paperback would come out much later when they wanted to kind
of... Like a year.
Yeah. And so basically they're saying, oh, you want to see it first? Okay, you must be a huge fan. Therefore, we will charge you more.
Well, no, a lot of people saw it first and didn't pay more, but these people chose to get the premium ticket and see it and be able to look and see John Green. It wasn't that all tickets on Thursday night were premium.
Right.
It was, and you could see it first just the same time. But if you wanted the special, special treat, then you pay extra.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, is John Green's work on YouTube and his work
with
as
his brother,
his work as a vlogger, is it popular because of the books, or are the books popular
because
of the... came first, the chicken or the egg here?
He would have been popular as a vlogger on his own. He would have been popular as an author. But, you know, it's always good to have social media and outreach. But I think he was successful in both areas. And some people have a lot of Twitter followers just because they're a famous author. They may not even be great Twitter people. But, you know, people just want to follow them because they like them. But it tends to be... You get a lot of Twitter fans because you're really good at Twitter. You may be famous. That's how they come to Stephen Fry at first. But they stay because he's actually really good at it and does a good job and is engaged. So John Green is successful at both these endeavors. And I think...
And they kind of feed off of each other, too,
seems. Certainly they feed. But nobody buys book after book after book just because he's a good vlogger.
Right.
I mean, these are just, you know, novels. They appeal to teenagers and adults. You know, Looking for Alaska, Paper... Is it Paper Cuts? Oh, heck, I always get the name wrong of the other book. But he's got four or five books, I believe. The only numbers I could find were about 1 million copies sold of The Fault in Our Stars. I think it's more than that by now. I would assume it could be substantially more. But again, you're talking about a phenomenon in the movie. Yeah, a lot more people saw that on opening weekend than ever bought the book.
Yeah, I remember when they showed a piece of this movie, The Fault in Our Stars, during CinemaCon this year.
Did you cry? Did you cry?
No, because, you know, it was kind of out of context. And, you know, after the excerpt, I think people were like, what is this movie about? The people who had seen or who had read the book were very excited about it. Everybody else was saying, this looks like a complete Debbie Downer. We don't want to see this movie.
It's a girl with an oxygen mask and a guy with one leg. And we're like, oh, I can't wait to see it.
Right. Exactly.
Oh, well, so that, you know, but that, it's a big success. They're big winners this week. They've been hitting young adult novels hard for a while, so I'm sure Hollywood will continue to go in there. But Tom Cruise has been dismissed as the loser this week. Not true. He made a good movie. It got very good reviews. It's opened up solidly around the world. We'll see where it ends up. They could both be winners.
Yeah, why not? Maleficent certainly is a winner.
They were, and there were a lot of winners at the Tony Awards.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, let's move on to our theater section this week. The Tony Awards were held last night. Now, did you watch the entire telecast?
I didn't watch a second of the telecast. I didn't even see any hopping. I was traveling between Birmingham and Atlanta, watching a lacrosse game, visiting some friends, and I asked people to tape it for me. They forgot. I could have gone online, but I just figured I'd come to it dry. So, you know, I missed the whole telecast. I did, of course, read up on the winners and the losers. It was sort of, you know, the front runners that people had picked ended up being the winners. Not a lot of surprises, but it was spread around. A lot of winners for this Tony Award. No show dominated so much that, you know, anybody went away empty-handed. So something for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, I guess after Neil Patrick Harris hosted the awards, the Tony Awards, for the past 3 years, here comes Hugh Jackman, and he, in interviews leading up to the awards telecast, said that he was kind of nervous, that everybody loved Neil Patrick Harris.
Yeah, yeah.
And so then he does this hopping thing, which I'm sure you've now read about.
Wait, a friend's texting me. Why is he what's going on? Why is he hopping? Is that something?
He literally bounced and hopped through the first 4.5 minutes of the Tony Awards. Literally.
Well, as anybody knows who looked it up, it is a tribute, an homage, if you will, to a little-known Busby Berkeley film called Small Town Girl.
That's right.
From 1953. The song is Take Me to Broadway. And apparently in that movie, they hopped around a lot. Now, Busby Berkeley, I don't think it's even a theater-based film. It's not about musical theater. But, you know, he is a big theatrical star who segued into movies. So, you know, he certainly is in the musical theater tradition in
but,
a way.
But it's the, I mean, the thing is like 60 years old, this movie. But, well, and it was little known to be. It doesn't
matter if 100 years old. Nobody's heard of it.
Exactly.
Even theater aficionados have no idea what he's talking about. So he's hopping around. It was like, why is Wolverine hopping?
Right. And so he hops into, and it was like a, kind of interesting because it was one long shot and broken up by the fact that he got onto an elevator. Right. With Neil Patrick Harris. And all of a sudden there was this awkwardness between them. Like, oh, hey, man, you're doing that bouncing thing.
And he hopped into jump roping with Rocky and all that. So, you know, intro'd the show. And hey, probably got a lot of YouTube hits, though. It was an odd choice to open the Tony Awards.
I don't know that it worked, to be honest.
OK, what really matters, of course, is not who wins what award, but who has the best performance on the show or perhaps a performance that can boost their show the most. Well, we already know that Hedwig did really well. It's a big hit at the box office. Neil Patrick Harris did a great job on the show. I know you liked it. What was the best performance that needed help? The show that needed something? Did Rocky have a good performance? Did Bullets Over Broadway? Did Violet? What was the show that could really use help that actually came through?
I think without a doubt, first of all, Rocky, I guess they did like a medley. And it just, whatever. It didn't work.
That's always a bad idea as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, it didn't work at all. It proved why you shouldn't make a musical out of Rocky. Congratulations, you figured that out. As far as Bullets Over Broadway, yeah, I think at that point it was in the third hour, nobody cared, and it didn't really help it at all. Violet with Sutton Foster, Oh my goodness. She got on stage, and all of a sudden, I mean, I was paying attention. She's always great to watch. Always great to watch. And of course, then all of a sudden, she started trending on Twitter like nobody's business.
Well, you know, I've seen her in a couple of the shows. I wasn't a huge fan. I mean, I liked her, but I wasn't a big fan of Anything Goes, that particular revival. But I liked Violet. I liked it a lot. I thought she was great. I thought the two male leads were terrific and sexy. If you're in New York, it's a good show to check out. So she could certainly use the boost. I didn't realize how much Beautiful, that's the musical about Carole King, how much that show really benefited from Carole King just attending the show. Now, that show was building a little bit as a word of mouth hit for fans who love musical theater. It's about the life of Carole King, the songwriter turned solo superstar with her blockbuster album Tapestry. And it got solid reviews. And I think it's a very well-made show and a well-acted show. It's not a great show, but the songs are good and the cast is as good as it's going to be. And it was doing fine. But then Carole King, who was reluctant to watch her life on stage and see her marriage disintegrate and her husband turn to drugs, you know, blah, blah, blah. She didn't want to go. And
she mentioned that during the show last night. She said,
right, yeah, she didn't want to go. And she left the first reading that she was attending. And said, you know what? I've lived it. I don't need to watch it again. And so she gave her blessing to the show, but she didn't go. She didn't even go to opening night. And people who love Carole King know that, like, she's not going to do something unless she wants to do it. She's not going to just be nice or give approval to something unless she really likes it. So it kind of hurt the show a little bit. It was becoming a thing. And so she finally said, I'm going to go. And she went incognito. She loved it. She went on stage, took a bow, sang with the star. That got tons of attention. And the box office exploded after that. It made a big, I'm kind of stunned. So it went on to become in the $1 million club, grossing $1 million a week. It's really done terrifically well at the box office since then. So there she was at the Tony Awards last night, performing with Jesse Mueller, who won Best Actress, very deservedly, for her performance in Beautiful as Carole King. They were together. They sang. It was beautiful.
It was a great moment, actually. That was one of the highlight moments. Of course, as you mentioned, Michael, the other highlight moment they placed perfectly in that third hour bridge there was Neil Patrick Harris performing as Hedwig in Hedwig and the Angry Inch. And boy, did he just tear it up.
I didn't watch the show. So a couple things. I love that Kenny Leon won for directing the revival of A Raisin in the Sun. I love that Clint Eastwood came out and made fun of himself. Because he was doing that talking to a chair thing again, wasn't he? Like he did at the Republican National Convention.
Well, they had these bumpers where they went backstage right before a commercial. Uh-huh. And there he was like talking to this empty chair.
That's funny.
And all of a sudden Hugh Jackman kind of came up and tapped him on the shoulder like, okay, Clint, we're going to, you know, it's your turn. He's like, oh, okay. And he like turned to the chair like, okay, I got to go now. You know, it's just like, I wondered how many people actually got that.
And of course, one of the big stories was, oh, Broadway's rejecting movie stars. They hate big famous people. They're turned to their own. Ridiculous. And you look at the winners, you've got Neil Patrick Harris and Bryan Cranston, who won for Best Actor in a Drama, both big TV stars, and they won Tony Awards. So, you know, that's kind of silly.
Yeah. Well, Bryan Cranston, I mean, what a year that guy is having.
Well, yeah, sure. Absolutely. And there will be another LBJ play in like a year or two that he's going to be part of. And it leaves the show in a few weeks, but it did just break even and start going to profitability. I know that Neil Patrick Harris is booked through August 17th, I think is the date when he's scheduled to leave Hedwig. So he'll either probably extend it a little bit, and then they're going to announce somebody else. Maybe Joseph Gordon-Levitt has been mentioned. We went through a list of people that could step into that role. So it'd be fun to see who takes it over and how they do.
Well, and the play that Bryan Cranston won for, it won Best Play. It's called All the Way, and it's about LBJ.
LBJ, right. And yeah. I just read that biography by Robert Caro. I read Volume 1, which is absolutely tremendous. If you're looking to read something good, and you like political biography at all, that Robert Caro biography is amazing. It only goes through like his early days from his childhood up to his early career as an aide and trying to run for his first office. So that's a tremendous book. I didn't even get to the section that this play covers, but I think the next play will cover, I don't know, Kennedy dying and him becoming president or pulling out of Vietnam or, you know, all that sort of stuff. I don't know where it goes, but it'll be fascinating to see. There haven't been a lot of plays. And the other thing I wondered is that playwright wrote The Kentucky Cycle, which won the Pulitzer Prize.
Right.
And at the time, Kevin Costner was going to turn it into a miniseries for HBO. Well, now miniseries are back in the vibe again. You know, those are the vogue, I should say. Those are the thing, and everybody loves them. Maybe The Kentucky Cycle will get revived as a project for television.
Who knows? I wonder, though, how A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder, which won Best Musical, this is the big prize, the last one they give out, that performance during the show kind of came in the middle of the show. It did fairly well. I mean, it was a pretty good performance. I can't remember the name of the actor who basically played, I don't know, like three or four different characters.
Jefferson Mays.
Yeah, he did this amazing, like, transformation in like less than 60 seconds. He played four different characters beautifully. The production goes on to win Best Musical. I wonder if
That probably was the best of those. I thought Beautiful might take it and win the top prize, but that's certainly the theater lovers musical of the year. It was very well made. Jefferson Mays is a terrific actor. Whether it'll certainly get a boost from its Tony win, and that will definitely help it on the road and for other productions down the street. But whether it will help bring it into profitability, we'll have to wait and see.
Well, what about Aladdin? Because that had a pretty good performance as well.
He won Best Supporting Actor. The guy playing the genie won Best Supporting Actor, and he did his big production number, A Friend Like Me. People remember it from the movie where Robin Williams did a showstopper, and he stops the show every night. That show was already in the Million Dollar Club, so it doesn't need any help, but it certainly is nice advertising.
And what you're talking about is James Monroe Eagleheart, who plays Aladdin, won.
That's right. And of course, another little bit of advertising, free advertising, was thrown out there for Ashley Madison.
Yes, that just made me, I thought, how weird is that? He's talking to Kelly O'Hara. So to introduce all of the nominees for a particular category, both the actresses in a play and musical.
He made a joke about the name The Bridges of Madison County referencing The Bridges of Ashley Madison County.
Yeah, he said, I thought it should have been The Bridges of Ashley Madison County. You were so hot as the mother in that show. And
show about infidelity, and Ashley Madison is a website for people who'd like to date. But, by the way, they're still in a relationship. So it's kind of like a website for cheaters.
Right.
And it's kind of like the Grindr for straight people. And in fact, a lot of the people on that website are evangelical Christians, but never mind.
Well, I thought it was very funny how he threw that line out there, Hugh Jackman did, and then he kind of turned around and went, you know what? If Google it.
they knew no one was going to know what it was.
Yeah, because it was just like, why are you mentioning this thing? But I would say the big eyebrow raiser, and I thought it was okay, was Hugh Jackman singing a song from The Music Man with, hip-hop artist T.I. and LL Cool J. At first, I thought, what is this, a plug for NCIS LA? I mean, why is LL Cool J there?
Well, I'm not quite sure why they were doing The Music Man. They're just, it's silly. You're trying to appeal to a wider audience, so you have people who have nothing to do with musical theater performing musical theater. It's, The people on Broadway, the theater people were like, what is this? But people who don't like Broadway seem to have been like, oh, that was all right.
Yeah, well, it was like Clint Eastwood there to present Best Director.
Well, no, but he's directing Jersey Boys, the big film production of Jersey Boys, one of the biggest hits in recent years. He's absolutely a perfectly reasonable choice to have on the Tony Awards. The movie comes out in a few weeks. Of course you should be there.
Right. Well, even if he calls the cripple of Inishman the cripple of Irishman.
Did he?
Yes.
Oh, you should start hanging out with John Travolta.
I mean, he did seem a little befuddled, but then the person who won Best Director for, I don't know whether it was a musical or...
Kenny Leon won for directing a play.
Yeah, it was Best Direction of a Musical for A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder.
Jarko or Darko, however one says his name, I don't know.
Darko Trezniak, and so he barely pronounced it the first time, so when he had to announce the
Darko.
Winner, he just went, Tony goes to Darko. he wasn't going to say it again.
Well, I said just say Donnie Darko and be done with it.
Yeah,
do they say the name of the show first? Because, that's my big thing. People don't know who the names of the people are. Well, so like when you're doing cinematography or score, so say the film first. So I guess they don't bother with the Tonys because there aren't that many technical awards.
Yeah, and they gave a lot of them out beforehand and then kind of did this quick, as they were coming back from commercials, they kind of quickly show who won certain technical lighting and set design awards. So that was kind of nice.
Well, it's hard. Those people, of course, want to be on camera, but you want to create a good show so people actually watch. About 7 million people watched, the same amount as last year when Neil Patrick Harris was the host. So Hugh Jackman did his job. It's not a big ratings draw, but, it's summertime, and it's probably a very lucrative audience since they have money, are older, more literate, probably more wealthy, and therefore is a pretty desirable demographic.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder, as you say, which shows will get the big bump? I don't know. They did in the middle of the show kind of talk about the American Theater Wing, that is, which puts on the Tonys, did talk about how it was kind of a record-breaking year on Broadway.
Oh, that's right. We had some statistics. Yeah, they had some stuff that they released right before the Tony Awards.
As they always do.
Of course, that's the end of the season. It's
right.
Not a coincidence. The season's over. They give out awards and say how many people went. This season, $1.27 billion were grossed on Broadway. That's a record. Premium pricing.
Yeah, so I was going to say, it's when you actually raise your ticket prices, there's a great, good way to raise more money.
They don't have extra seats, so if they all sell out, the only way to increase your revenue is to charge more. And attendance was up to 12.2 million theatergoers, which includes 4 straight guys. No, just kidding. That's better than last season, but not as high as the attendance 2 years ago. That would be the 2011-2012 season. So it's not a record number of theatergoers, but it's a solid, decent amount. They had about 44 new shows, including 12 new musicals, 4 revivals, 10 new plays, 14 play revivals, and various odds and ends. So that's a pretty good mix of shows. 12 new musicals is a lot. That's one a month. And the big winners, of course, were The Lion King, which came within a smidge of grossing $100 million last year. I don't know if that's ever happened before. I don't think it has. So they're getting close to $100 million. Wicked grossed $96 million. The Book of Mormon grossed $90 million. And the biggest newcomer is Kinky Boots with $80 million. And right behind it, Motown with $67 million and Matilda with $62 million. So you look at a movie, an opening weekend, of course. You get thousands of screens all over the country. Everyone can go at once. On Broadway, they got to recreate that magic every night. And that's why it takes you an entire year to gross $100 million.
Yeah, and they also pointed out last night during the show that I guess they statistically or demographically they attracted more younger theatergoers. I don't know how they proved that or did that.
Well, they get demographics based on credit card sales and who the person is. They get stats and figures that are divorced from your actual name. So they know women versus men, rough age. They don't know they exactly. And of course, sometimes you have shows where they just buy a ticket. They don't have kid prices. So if you take your 2 kids to Aladdin, they know a person who's 34 bought it, but they don't know that they brought their 2 children. But, they look at the audience. They do all sorts. They do polls and all that sort of thing. So,
they figure it out. Well, between younger theater goers, more money.
A little more diverse, I think. It depends on the year and what shows are out there. But, you know, the audience is a little more diverse sometimes. It's still pretty gray.
Everything's up, which is important.
Well, yeah, over last year. So that's a big deal.
Oh, if that's a big deal, then we should probably move on to Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story is, you know, we happen to spend our time here at Showbiz Sandbox focusing on entertainment news. You know, there are other events, in fact, around the world worth taking note of. So
that's right. We say, like, how will this earthquake affect box office?
Exactly.
Sensitive, touching thoughts like that.
Well, there are stories such as, say, a singing nun that won the Italian version of The Voice.
Someone told me about that yesterday. Yeah. I haven't watched her yet.
But that's not really what this next item is about. In fact, it's much more serious. In a way. You see, over in Thailand, there was a bit of a military coup recently because, well, I think actually it was just that time of year again. They seem to have so many military coups.
I have a friend living in Bangkok right now, and I'm like, hey, is it time to come home? And it's not an anti-foreigner coup. There's no anti-foreigner sentiment. He's safe and he's fine, but it is a little odd. It's like, there's a coup.
Yeah. Well, you know, to get to the point, protesters of the military junta have taken to spontaneously performing the three-fingered salute of defiance made famous in the Hunger Games movies.
Shut up, really?
Yes, yes.
No, really? Or is that just something that somebody did once? People are all doing that?
Well, certain people are doing that.
Well, the protesters are, though.
Right, exactly. You know, of course.
Are there, like, photos of all of them, like, holding their three fingers up?
Yes, there are photos of this.
That's hilarious. And weird.
And then there, right next to them, are photos of a Lionsgate paying off all of the... No, just kidding. Of course, military juntas, by their very nature, they don't like protests or the salutes derived to represent any form of defiance. So they're now threatening, the military juntas, that is, to crack down on anyone practicing the three-fingered wave. Now, you know, I almost feel like there needs to be a joke in here about, you know, Thai protesters capitulating to the military junta and reverting to a one-finger wave. But, Michael, is Thailand's new Hunger Games hello greeting a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop in the scheme of things, but if that somehow gives them a sense of solidarity, I guess it's all right. But that's very odd. I mean, and also, like, yep, I'm protesting. It gets you in trouble, so you really pay a price.
Yes.
I see a picture with one guy doing it, but I'd love to see a picture of, like, 1,000 people doing it. That would make me think it's more than just, I mean, I don't know, was it a joke somehow, but it caught on? That's just so weird.
I think that's exactly right. I think it started out as kind of a joke, and it's
just
caught on.
And then they're like, down with it.
Right.
If it bothers the government, we're down with it.
Well, now, this next story we haven't really written up, but hey, you know what? You probably watch Game of Thrones, Michael, right?
All men must die. Sperling, all men must die.
I have no idea what that means.
That's the tagline from this season.
I don't, actually.
Winter is coming. You know that one.
Yes, I haven't. I'm not a big, you know, sword and sandal kind of guy, so.
Not a sword and sandal. That's biblical epic. Sword and sorcery is the term you were looking for.
Yes.
Game of Thrones is on HBO. It's based on the novels by George R.R. Martin, the cycle called A Song of Ice and Fire. He just announced there might be an 8th book. It was supposed to be a trilogy, then a pentateuch or something, a pentagram. I don't know, 5 books. Now it's up to 7 they're planning. But now maybe his editor said, maybe there'll be 8. Anyway, it is now the biggest rated TV show in HBO history. It just passed The Sopranos this season with its average audience peaking over 18 million viewers, I think, per week.
Yes, 18.4 million viewers per week.
Right. And what I love is that they gave us a breakdown.
Well, 21- I found the breakdown.
Oh, you did. Well, you found it. They could have hidden it.
True.
They didn't have to say it. So what's the breakdown? How are they watching this show?
21% of viewers, of those 18 million viewers, are watching the show live on HBO when it first airs.
Sunday night at 9 or 10 p.m., wherever they might be. Okay.
And I guess HBO likes to replay Game of Thrones again and again and again. And 25%, so more people, watch the replays.
Okay. And then?
32% will watch it on DVR.
That would be me, someone like me, yeah.
Then there's this little thing called HBO Go or Video On Demand. 22% of Game of Thrones viewers are watching it that way.
So that's fascinating. The least popular option is to watch it live.
Correct, yes.
That's kind of, that is the future. Why would you, who needs to bother to be there at 9 p.m. sitting in front of your TV? You know, it's just not convenient. So people say, oh, I'll watch it on replay at 10 p.m. or 11 p.m. because they usually show it a couple times that night and then once or twice during the week and then again the next week right before. Or maybe I'll watch it on DVR or I'll just catch it on HBO to go. That's kind of fascinating. That's kind of cool.
And of course, still, I think people are saying, gee, we really have no idea how many people are truly seeing Game of Thrones because it is one of the most illegally, if not the most illegally downloaded television show in the United States, if not the world.
That's right. So it's a big hit. It's a big hit by network standards, just like The Sopranos was.
Right.
And they had a little down period where they didn't have a big show for a while. So, you know, they've got a couple now. They're firing on good cylinders. They've got some good shows. And this is a monster hit. And it's only, what, season three?
I don't know. I do know that.
Or
that
season four. I think
George R.R. Martin better get writing because he hasn't finished book six.
Well, he'll be all right because they're splitting the books up into two seasons.
Oh, okay.
And in fact, next season, I believe, covers book four, or technically will start to cover book four. But because of the way the books are done, books four and five, they'll be covering a quarter of book four and a quarter of book five because they both take place at the same time. So it's like, book four and five are sort of one big book covering all the fantasy world that's going on. And there's so many characters that he split it up into two books. So you basically have half the characters in one book and half the characters in the other book. But HBO isn't about to say, well, we'll just ignore those actors for a year or 2 years. So they're going to have to slice and dice that puppy up like never before. So a lot of people watching Game of Thrones, they're watching it in brand new ways. That's kind of fascinating. And it's one of the biggest hits on television. I mean, it's right up there with The Walking Dead and breathing down the necks of The Big Bang Theory and NCIS, and they're not done yet. It's still growing.
And what I would tell Mr. Martin is less attending Comic-Con, writing the sixth book.
You don't even read the books or watch the show. Leave them alone. Take as long as you want, Mr. Martin. The one thing I would say is that the books have sold about 24 million copies in North America. That's for all five books. So you figure like maybe 8 million people bought the first book and then some people drop off. So the last book, maybe 4 or 5 million read it. You know, I'm sure it's pretty consistent, but a lot of people probably started the first one that didn't continue. So you're talking about 5 or 6 million people who've read all five books in North America. So the TV show is reaching a lot more people than ever read the books. And of course, it's fantasy, which television never does well. It's almost...
Don't you mean sword and sorcery?
Yeah, fantasy. Sorcery is a genre of fantasy, but it's by definition the greatest fantasy TV series of all time, because, I mean, there's almost no competition. You've got, like, Hercules and Xena, which are silly, and, you know, a couple other shows which aren't even that good. So this is it, baby. It's the greatest fantasy TV show of all time.
Okay. Well, you might recall our discussing a few weeks ago the salacious lawsuit alleging sexual abuse filed against filmmaker Bryan Singer and three other men, including Gary Goddard and Garth Ansier. Well, Michael Egan, the plaintiff in that case, he has voluntarily dismissed his suit against one of those men, David Newman. You see, Egan's allegations against the former Disney executive were undermined by his own sworn statements in a previous case proclaiming Newman innocent of any wrongdoing. As we alluded to when first reluctantly breaching this subject, it's beginning to seem like Egan's case is exactly what it initially appeared to be.
Oh, I don't know. I wouldn't say that.
Well,
when you're in a case and you want to deal with other people, you sometimes say things 8-10 years ago, however long ago that was, 5 years ago, that aren't true. Not because you're like, you just don't want to deal with all that. So I'm not trying to get Mr. Newman in trouble or say, oh, he's clearly guilty because someone accused him of it. That's not fair. But the fact that somebody giving hundreds of hours of private sworn testimony and things with their lawyers and depositions, that they said something that now they regret because, in fact, they would like to go into it and talk about what somebody may or may not have done, does not mean that, you know, contradicting yourself in that way does not necessarily mean you're lying now. We're just doing it to get more money. He came forward at the time. He approached the cops. He approached the FBI. He, you know, he was not. And just because he didn't want to deal with everybody, all these powerful people, and he went after one who actually was clearly a pedophile and escaped overseas and is now a registered sex offender. I'm not willing to say, oh, well, just because he did not tar all these other people at the time and said things like, oh, you know, they didn't do anything. They weren't involved. You know, that to me is like he regrets that now, but I don't think it means he's lying now. And I don't mean to say that it means that they're clearly guilty either. But, you know, you say something off the cuff because you're not focusing on those other people. You just want to focus on this one person. You know, it's a long testimony. And when you don't want to deal with other people and you just say, oh, well, you know, they weren't involved.
Well, is this dismissal then a big deal then?
Well, it's a big deal for David Newman. It's obviously a weight off his shoulders. It's obviously an opportunity for the lawyers to paint him, as you say, as a money grabber who's lying and contradicting himself, which may or may not be the case. How do I know? All I know is there was smoke and fire there before, and these guys obviously were hanging out with the wrong people. It's the best thing you can say about him.
That's
it's
true.
Ugly. It's unpleasant. But I don't want to. I'm not going to turn around and say, "Oh, this kid's a liar." You know.
It's I'm not saying. Yeah. No,
well,
I'm
of course you did. You said he was grabbing for money.
No, I said it seems like it's turning out to be what a lot of people were saying, a desperate money grab.
Other people appear. Well, you sound like their lawyer. So it's ugly. I'm sorry we had to even talk about it, but you know, it was a big deal. And this dismissal is certainly a vindication for Newman.
Yes. Jupiter Rising, the next film from the Wachowski siblings, was due to open in 6 weeks, July 18th, but not anymore. Warner Brothers pushed the film into 2015, where it will now be released on February 6th. The studio said the $150 million film, which stars Channing Tatum and Mila Kunis, needs more time for additional visual effects. However, given how close the release date was, the move had many in Hollywood raising, well, you know, a few eyebrows. Is the delay of Jupiter Rising's release date a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big deal. You know, it's one thing to change the release date. It's another thing to change the release date hours before the movie comes out.
Yes.
And I thought, well, who knows? It doesn't mean anything. Doesn't, you know, it wasn't tracking well, whatever. They found a better position. They've spent money already to promote. Who knows? Who knows? And then I saw a photo of Channing Tatum in character and his little pointy ears, and he looks ridiculous. So.
I have to say, you know, they were both Mila Kunis and Channing Tatum were at CinemaCon to promote this film.
God bless them.
They looked on stage, they looked so uncomfortable promoting this film. They were like,
really?
Oh, yeah, we're kind of.
Yeah, we're in this movie. Go movie.
Yeah. And I think I didn't know at the time whether it was, well, gee, you know, the movie's either not that good or they didn't have a good time making it or they haven't seen the movie. So they have no idea what they're promoting because, of course, it's a sci-fi film. All they did was like show up and make up with a green screen. They have no clue what they're.
But he knows he was wearing pointy ears and looked foolish.
Right. And I think now it's kind of slowly beginning to be like, no, this film is in trouble. And
I can't wait to go back to being a stripper.
Right. Exactly.
That's what Tanning was saying.
Magic anyway, Mike 2.
Yeah, it's happening.
I know. Exactly. Well, now, is NBC's sitcom Community really dead? The show that came back to life, lost its creator Dan Harmon, got him back again, and then was canceled for good by the network. It may be coming back. There's a possibility that Hulu, remember them? They will sign the show up for one more season, a la Netflix and Arrested Development. Hulu needs a signature show, and why not go the easy route by signing up someone else's signature show? Well, it wasn't exactly a signature show for NBC, but I guess it was kind of a ratings behemoth. Well, not really ratings behemoth, but a beloved cult series. Yeah, that's about right, a beloved cult series. And beloved and cult is another way of saying, quote-unquote, big online, which is exactly where Hulu lives. Creator Dan Harmon is interested, and this is a quote from him, "I'm not going to be the guy that re-cancels canceled Community." Big deal or big whoop?
The definition of big whoop.
Okay.
Maybe it'll come back. Maybe it won't. Maybe it's good for Hulu. Maybe it keeps them from creating their own actual signature show, just trying to piggyback on a final season of another show. Not the worst idea in the world. It worked for Netflix and Arrested Development. But, you know, we'll see.
Filmmaker Oliver Stone is no stranger to making movies about political controversial figures. Ergo, his movies Nixon, about Richard Nixon, and W, about George W. Bush.
And there's one about, like, Chavez and the whole South American, Central American political thing.
Right, and then there's JFK and Platoon and Born on the 4th of July. You get the picture. Well, now, Mr. Stone is focusing his attention on Edward Snowden, he of NSA leakage fame. Stone recently visited Snowden in Moscow, where the former NSA employee has sought political asylum, and the director called him a hero. Like anything in Hollywood, however—
He is a hero.
There are now two competing projects about Snowden. Stone's is going to be based on a book written by The Guardian newspaper's Luke Harding, whereas Sony is adapting Glenn Greenwald's No Place to Hide, a book about his work with Snowden, making NSA surveillance public through his reporting in that very same newspaper, The Guardian. Is Stone's proposed film on Snowden a big deal or a big whoop, or are the two competing films a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, remember Julian Assange.
Yes. Well.
It's hard to make a good movie out of this. I'm not sure what the arc is. Anything could be interesting or fascinating. It's hard when something is so fresh and in the news to make a good rip from the headlines film. You kind of want a more process it down the road. But, you know, it could make a good movie. It sounds like a big whoop. I'm not sure that they have described to me what arc they're going to do or whatever. But certainly if he makes a film, it'll be portraying Edward Snowden in all its complexity, but absolutely as a hero.
So the renowned Budapest Festival.
And I wouldn't say, oh, by the way, I wouldn't say he sought political asylum in Moscow. He got trapped in Moscow is what it was. He was on his way to another country and the U.S. was able to stop him from proceeding any further. And he was forced to go to Russia. He doesn't want to be there any more than anyone else would want to be there.
Okay.
And I don't mean, I like Russia, but I mean, you know, as far as you're seeking political asylum, you don't want to end up in Russia. You know, that's not where you want to be. A country with, like, he's fighting for freedom of the press and freedom of information. That's not the country where you want to start in.
All right. You can direct all of your emails to. No, just kidding.
Yeah, Edward Putin, give me a call.
Edward Putin.
Well, who else is going to be angry? The Russian people don't like it.
Well, the renowned Budapest Festival Orchestra, they're in New York, Michael, for a show or two.
I saw this. Yeah.
And like many of us who go through customs at JFK, they're a little bit frustrated. Actually, the orchestra went through customs at Newark International Airport, which is kind of nearby. It's about 15 miles away from Manhattan. But their instruments went through customs at John F. Kennedy International Airport.
How did that happen?
I don't know. I'm sure cargo, who knows?
Oh, it shouldn't go to a different airport. But anyway.
Well, over at JFK, the bows used by the orchestra's violin players were seized due to what officials believed was African elephant ivory used to make the bows. Orchestra reps had all the proper paperwork to prove that the bows, though made of ivory, were not made from band ivory. But still, the violin players had to borrow equipment to perform at a pair of Lincoln Center concerts. The bows will be allowed to return to Hungary upon the orchestra's departure. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop, of course. It's very annoying for them, and it's stupid since they did everything they should have done to prepare for this and knew what, you know, paperwork they needed. It's a blot on the airline and those people. But I have friends who are in the miniatures business, miniatures made out of ivory from hundreds of years ago, little portraits done in miniature in ivory. And, you know, they have all sorts of trouble. That market's collapsing because they can't sell it. You're not allowed to sell it. You kind of take it overseas, but then you're accused of smuggling. You know, that's like we're talking about ivory that has been off the elephant for 200, 300 years. So it's not exactly encouraging the current, you know, destruction of elephants and the ivory trade if you're talking about pieces of art made in the 1700s. So it's all a big mess.
Well, that kind of wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you.
So here's what happened. In Paris, Abel Ferrara, acclaimed, iconic, independent filmmaker, had a movie called Welcome to New York. And despite the rules, they went around the rules in France, which have very complicated rules governing film. And they released a movie on video on demand in the premium format, video on demand premium, whatever that means. But they released it on demand the same day this movie opened in theaters in France. Is
actually,
that right?
Actually, before it opened in movies.
Okay, even before,
and
which
so
is
premium,
even more
premium
scandal.
Premium is like when you pay like $40, $50 to see the movie instead of just the $7 that you would normally pay.
So, mon Dieu. So this
and they didn't even release it in PVOD, which is premium video on demand. They just released it video on demand.
Oh, okay.
And the head of co-founder of Wild Bunch, he's the, you know, this is the production company and distributor that paid for the film. It's a French company. Vincent Maravel, he sent out a tweet saying, look, in our first week, we had 100,000 viewings in our first week. So nothing will ever be the same again, because now we can prove that you can release a film and actually have it do well on VOD without a theatrical release. And it was a thumbing of the nose, the nose.
Haven't we known that for years?
Yes.
That happens in the U.S. all the time, has done so for years, especially for independent, smaller films like this. This is not a major blockbuster release for France. I mean, it did extremely well on video on demand because it's one of the few to do it. So it got a lot of attention as being one of the first where you could actually pay to see it.
Well, it also got a lot of attention because of its subject matter. It's a Dominique Strauss.
It's Abel Ferrara. Yeah. And it's about a hot button French topic, meaning the Dominique Strauss case, right?
Yes. And
it's Dominique Strauss con, right? Is that how you say it?
And it got a lot of attention in Cannes. It also got a lot of attention for being a really bad movie. So,
right, but that's why you video on demand it, because it's scandalous. Everybody wants to say, oh, what are they talking about? And the reviews aren't going to be great, and you're going to make most of your money early on anyway. And it's really a cause célèbre, and it's an art house fair. But Strauss-Kahn is the guy who was accused of raping the maid in the hotel, correct?
Correct, yes.
Right, okay, so it's that case when he was in New York. So it's a hot button topic. Hot button film, a filmmaker who's not a top grossing filmmaker anywhere in the world, but he's certainly a well-known name brand. So it's ideal for video on demand. But isn't that what's been happening in America? I don't understand why. I understand in France there were more barriers to making this happen, but isn't this just confirming what we already know? That certain movies with name brand people can do well on video on demand.
Well, you know that. I know that. And
the movie industry knows that. They've been doing it for years in America.
Well, and it's beginning to more and more. The question has always been, though, and this is, you know, I'm going to give a plug to Patrick Von Sikowski, who I would have had as a guest on this show. However, he's in Singapore, so the timing just is completely off. So we you know, he's asleep right now. But he did an amazing piece over at Celluloid Junkie. And I'm not just trying to plug an outlet that I write
for. Why not?
but he did this amazing piece that really kind of laid out, mostly through referencing other sources, the fact that it's not affecting theatrical grosses. So even though VOD is becoming commonplace, it's becoming the norm now. And when you see somebody
it's the norm for small independent films and art house fare. It's not the norm for big blockbuster releases.
Correct. And as John Fithian has always said, is, you know, this is, John Fithian is the head of the National Association of Theater Owners, NATO. He has always said, look, this is something that exhibitors and distributors should be working on together. And, you know, he's been pointing that out. Now, slowly, it's actually beginning to happen where theater owners and distributors, at least in some of these for some of these smaller films, are working on it together.
Well, yeah, they say, look, we're releasing this on video on demand as well as putting it in 30 theaters.
Correct. Yes.
Right?
And
stuff
and
like
usually
that.
The VOD stuff is watched by people who geographically couldn't go to a theater because it's not showing anywhere right. near them.
Even if they wanted to. And it's a rare film that might open in a tiny release pattern and unbeknownst to the studio turn into a blockbuster hit that they would want to put out on 1,000 screens. They can have hits or they can have big movies that they open limited that they know they're going to expand. But it's all very, very rare that there be some film that they would actually, you know, say, oh, we really do want to release it in Oklahoma.
Well, Margin Call is a perfect example of that. A couple of years
ago,
that had
high profile names in it, and that was a classic platform release, wasn't it? I mean, they wouldn't necessarily say they were going to have it on 1,000 screens, but that was a movie that they had, I think, serious potential for.
Yes.
Whereas Welcome to New York, Disabled for Horror film, you'd have no desire to open it wide in America. It's not going to happen.
No, it's not going to happen at all.
Yeah, when you get great reviews for
Maybe.
Margin Call and become an Oscar, well, that's a movie you want to milk.
Yes, and there was a report released sometime around the Cannes Film Festival called The Circulation of European Films in the Digital Era, and really what that's pointing out is what we kind of knew already in the industry, which is that really these VOD releases, they are allowing people to see these films in geographic places where they wouldn't otherwise be able to see them, as we just mentioned. They're allowing films that might not be able to get a theatrical release because there are just too many movies in theaters. They can't even get the screen space, so they're allowing them to be seen, and they're allowing, you know...
Or to not be seen, as the case may be.
Right. And they're actually raising the profile of films that are being shown in theaters.
Yeah, I mean, it's very rare that it's gonna, you know, if it's a good movie, and people see it, they'll talk about it and say they like it, whether they see it on video on demand or in a theater, or later on Blu-ray. So, yeah, I mean, obviously word of mouth is good, but there's nothing magical about video on demand that makes extra word of mouth.
And maybe the reason mentioning this at all is because one of the bullet points, as Patrick points out here, is concerning the economics of the system as a whole, the experiments in VOD seem to indicate that there is no major risk. VOD consumption mainly concerns the zones where the film is not visible or only limited to a degree. There's no risk to theaters, at least...
There is a risk if they try to do it with a major studio film like they tried. When was it Universal? Said, hey, we're going to try. And they're like, what?
Oh,
never
well,
mind.
Yeah.
We're not going to show your film.
That Eddie Murphy movie. Right.
Right. It's a big, they haven't tried to do it with Godzilla. That
right.
would be a big risk to the theater owners. You can do it with Abel Ferrara's Welcome to New York. Knock yourself out. But sorry, when you start to play with the next Star Wars movie, and you say, oh, we think we'll do that a video on demand, too, because that'll be fun to see what happens. And then you'll see some fireworks. It's not an experiment as far as I'm concerned. They've been doing it for years.
But, you know, what's really interesting, I think, is the mindset has changed. It used to be that if you went direct to VOD, your movie was absolutely horrible.
Well, they didn't go direct to VOD. They have a theatrical release as well.
Right. But I think now going either direct to VOD or
no. What name day a good movie that's gone direct to VOD that was never in theaters?
I don't know.
There's none. Because if it's a good enough movie, it'll get a theater. I mean, it'll happen someday, and it may have happened already. But by and large, if you're good enough, you're going to get released in a theater. You may have a video on VOD day and date, but you're going to probably get a theatrical play. There are some movies that only play film festivals. That's true. And there's companies like Film Movement, which has a monthly movie where they say, hey, we found this gem. We really like it. And they actually now get them a theatrical release because there are screens available via IFC and others. But, you know, they actually do that sometimes day and date. But they put it out on DVD and say, hey, we love this movie. We saw it at a film festival. It didn't get any attention. Here it is. There are good movies like that. There are films that only play festivals. But if you're talking about a movie that has commercial potential, they're not just going to VOD. They're going to get a release.
Well, and it's through these multi-platforms that people are actually making money now. These films are actually, you know, making money.
Well, do we have any numbers?
No, we don't.
Do we know how much it made in France on this 100,000 views in 1 week? Any idea what the gross was?
Well, 7 euros times 100,000. So
it was only 7 euros is what they paid?
Yes.
So it's 700,000 euros. That's about $1 million, which is a lot for a tiny film like that in France.
Correct. In one country.
Right, right. In France, also known as one country.
Right.
Yeah. But $1 million US is pretty darn good.
Yes.
For this film. I mean, it won't make that much in North America overall if it's released.
I don't think so.
I would guess, yeah. And maybe it's already been released. I don't know. Yeah, it certainly won't. The Strauss-Kahn story. Nobody cares about that here.
Well,
so it's interesting. I don't know if it's an I wouldn't call it an experiment anymore. And I would say it's strictly limited to art house fare. But it's interesting to see it spreading more and more overseas. Is that the story here?
And that it's becoming the new norm.
It's not the new norm. It's the new norm for a certain type of film that it's already been the new norm for several years. We've talked about it before.
Well, I don't know. I mean, in 2006, you had Bubble.
That was 8 years ago.
Well, I guess that's true. You know, I keep thinking that it was like, a couple of years ago.
I had somebody on Facebook who says, yeah. A friend said, does anybody buy CDs anymore? I'm still buying a CD. I bought a new CD yesterday. Another said, oh, CDs are dead. And this one guy said, yeah, I wish I could get rid of my DVDs and just buy digital. But it seems like studios are scared about it. They don't even want to make them available. I'm like, no, in fact, it's available before it comes out on DVD. So you can buy most new movies on digital download before it comes out on Blu-ray and DVD. So you might want to check again.
Actually,
that's the new norm for digital.
If you follow me on Instagram or if you go to SperlingSpeaks.com, you'll see an image that I took, a photo that I took, then posted to Instagram and my Tumblr account there, SperlingSpeaks.com. And you'll see that I was at Costco over the weekend and I took a picture of the display case for the Lego movie, which was not a display case of DVDs or Blu-rays. In fact, it was just a display case of little cardboard cutouts with the Lego movie. They were selling the HD download, which you could get 2 weeks before the DVD or the Blu-ray was released. And they're selling it in a warehouse store, a digital download.
Very cool. Yeah, I saw a TV ad where they said, get it now before everybody else on digital. Oh, it was the Liam Neeson film. There's somebody on this plane. You know, that film, Nonstop. And it was a TV ad.
I was going to say, isn't that like Taken 9 Nonstop?
It was a TV ad touting the digital download, not only saying it's available now, but like get it before it comes out on DVD 2 weeks from now.
Yeah. Okay.
Which I haven't seen. I don't watch commercials, but I hadn't seen that before. They're like, aha, digital download, get it first. Well, all right. We'll keep an eye on that. It's been the new norm for a while, but now it's spreading overseas.
Right. Now, last week, we talked a little bit about the Tonys, as we did this week, because, of course, they were held this week. But we had somebody write in, and I wish I could say who. I don't know who, because they specifically wanted to remain anonymous. They wrote into dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. And
I had no idea Edward Snowden was a fan of our show.
I had no idea either.
Or is it Guy Fawkes? I don't know.
I don't know. I think it's somebody that works for, well, you'll read this.
Don't get him in trouble.
It could be a woman. It could be a woman.
Well, of course, them. I said them.
Okay.
Didn't I? Maybe. I don't mean to be sexist. All right. Shall I read this?
Sure.
Oh, this is fresh for me. He or she doesn't even say dear Showbiz Sandbox or dear kids or whatever. But anyway, they say, like to keep us anonymous if I can, and you'll see why. I heard you discussing the Tonys last week and how certain productions pay to be a part of the telecast. Just wanted to say how correct you are in pointing this out. Kudos to Sperling for that. As someone who works on the business side of the Tonys for a particular network, guess which one? Tiffany. I can assure you, productions pay a small fortune for their appearance during the ceremony. This does not mean a production can necessarily buy their way into the show, or necessarily or not at all. However, if they are selected, they have to not only cover their production expenses, but pay for placement. Oh, so like if you're earlier in the show or at a key good moment right at the beginning when viewership is really high, you pay more, just like you do on the Super Bowl. You don't want to be in the fourth quarter. Those are cheaper. So I think it was A Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder. I think that was early in the show, wasn't it, Sperling?
It was like within the first hour
and
they
a half. Paid, they must have paid a premium to be there.
Actually, Les Mis was right up front. I thought, okay, well, that's a sure bet.
Yeah. So performances, this person says, at the beginning of the show cost more than those during the middle or in some years, the end. Often these costs are built into a production marketing budget, and even shows that have no hope of lasting more than a year will pay for their spot simply to appease some producer's ego. The production cost of any performance is not taken into account, so even if you have a single performer on stage with no sets or props, you can still wind up paying some serious bank. Right, they don't care how elaborate your production is, you got to pay to be there.
Right.
It can get complex because telecast producers and the network itself also have a say. That means a production that is more popular or widely known, or one that features a big-name talent, might be slotted earlier to keep viewers tuned in and then have to pay more than they may have been anticipating. So, you know, we're happy in the second half. They're like, no, you're going to be up front.
Yeah,
because obviously they want to pace the show and decide what goes where and keep people to stay tuned in to watch Neil Patrick Harris and see what crazy things he does. All right. So this person says, however, some shows that have the budget to go early can get pushed back because the ceremony's producers don't want them up front. There's usually one big anticipated production number held to the third hour bridge as a way of building anticipation and teasing viewers. Was that where Neil performed?
That's exactly right. Now, a third hour bridge is literally going from the second hour into the third hour of the show. So it's literally
was
the bridge.
Was it a 3-hour show?
Yeah. Yes, I think it was. Yes, it was, actually.
There aren't that many awards. In many years, productions consider that a lucky spot to get because the cost is much less, but they get the added benefit of being plugged early and often. Oh, that's true. It's like a little mini ad. None of this touches on the licensing of the music for the telecast, which you think might be donated to the productions for marketing purposes, but I can tell you firsthand, it's paid for by the network. What I'm trying to say is you shined a spotlight on the little-known practice of how the television network and mostly the American Theater Wing make a small fortune off the Tonys, even though, of course, it only reached 7 million people. Thanks for the show. All right. Well, thanks for writing in. That's interesting. Strong confirmation of what Sperling brought up.
Well, you also kind of said, yes, they do have to pay.
Well, they have to pay, but I'm like, it's not like they're like, oh, no, I have to pay. They're like, yay, I get to pay and be on the show.
Oh, yeah. I think I think the point where this person said, the person who wrote in said, you know, it's built into their marketing budget. So they're happy to pay it because it's already accounted for. I think it's, you know, they're, it's almost like, yes, we get to pay this wonderful tax for being so popular and great.
Cool. All right. Well, thanks for writing in. Thanks for being anonymous. And thanks for not blowing up Parliament, I guess.
Oh, because this is a Guy Fawkes
reference. Yeah.
Okay.
and they just opened up Parliament, of course, in London just a few days ago. And of course, they have to ceremoniously search through the cellar of Parliament to make sure there are no more bombs sitting there. They have a big sort of course in Britain. If they did it once, they do it for 500 years. And there they go, looking for bombs and a nice little ceremony caught on camera and displayed on C-SPAN. So no bombs and Parliament went off fine.
Well, okay. Again, this particular listener wrote into dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter. Our username on Twitter is @showbizsandbox or just showbizsandbox. Again, we're also on Facebook. So if you go to Facebook and search for Showbiz Sandbox, our page should come up. You can like us there. You can subscribe to the show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, or Stitcher. Anywhere they give podcasts away for free or aggregate podcasts, that's where you can find us listed. And we do kind of urge you to subscribe to the show or to rate and review the show in any one of those podcast platforms. It does help us out. All of those links, as well as links to all of the stories we talked about on today's show, can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's, again, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They could be found on MySpace or on their website, who is MGMT.com. Michael Giltz has a website. It rotates every week. This week, Michael, what is it?
It is the Institute to Prevent Nonstop Hopping.org. because it's a non-profitable website. Actually, my website is a non-profitable website. It's a non-profit institute to help people like Hugh Jackman who suffer from the malady of nonstop hopping.
Okay, well,
don't make fun. It's not a funny thing.
Okay, well, you know what? If you can't find any of Michael's work relating to the entertainment industry there, try michaelgiltz.com or run on over to the Huffington Post, where some of his writing about the entertainment industry can be found. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.